I think we should be ready to start, or we have. Let me welcome those who have been away on other assignments. We miss you. I want to dearly so. But as the chair, I was always in the comfort of those committee members who were around. We set the ship in your absence, but on behalf of the committee. What is this? Oh, yes. We do have an apology of Honorable Chabalala, who is abroad, and Honorable Swart, Steve Swart. The honorable members were taking presentations, it's public hearing basically, for the draft taxation, I mean tax administration amendment bill. We have about five presentations that we are going to take. The first one is supposed to be PricewaterhouseCoopers. Are they here? Okay. South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, you are here? All right. I think we'll start with. Are you ready? Good. Thank you. Yeah. Continue. We'll apologize for starting before his arrival.
What we essentially want to discuss today are issues that we've covered in our submission that was made to the National Treasury and SARS after the bills and within the period that allowed us to make comment. We want to talk about the regulation of tax practitioners, issues that we raise on provisional tax, and it's two other small minor issues that I would like to address in our submission today as well. We are aware that National Treasury has also responded to the issues, already responded to some of the issues that we've raised in our submission, and the document it was released on the 11th of September, which principally dealt with the Tax Relations Law Amendment Bill. Now, our first topic that we're going to cover is the regulation of tax practitioners. I will take you through that, and if my colleague wants to add, we'll take some of your comments as well. Just to put it in perspective, I thought it was important to start with the current law, which took effect from the 1st of October this year, and then to lead that into the new proposals following from that. The Act currently, that's the Tax Administration Act, defines a controlling body, the body established whether voluntary or under law, and it's important for us to put emphasis on that voluntary or under law, with the power to take disciplinary action against a person who is carrying on a profession contravenes the applicable rules of those of that profession. Then, also required as the old Income Tax Act, one before the amendment that took effect on the 1st of October, that all persons that deal with SARS as tax practitioners must be registered with SARS. So the current law requires that. When it deals with a tax practitioner, it basically allows a person to do tax work for no consideration. We have commented on that in the past. It's my experience, certainly, that there are a lot of people that are doing tax work that are not asking for that, and they're not registered with SARS as tax practitioners. And I think that's an important point to remember. The current law also allows for SARS to lodge a complaint with the controlling body, the ones that we have listed up top there, such as BICA, for instance, is one of the controlling bodies, to lodge a complaint if a member does not conduct the tax services that he or she renders within the applicable rules that is applicable to our profession. Now, and then I thought I would also just give you an overview of the services involved in tax. I believe that one starts with a taxing event. That would be a sale or a transaction, or from a capital gains point of view, transfer duty, value-added tax, etc. And it typically would involve obtaining information about the transaction, compiling as well the financial report that is normally also necessary, then furnishing a return to SARS, enable SARS to issue a tax assessment based on that, and SARS would then say that. Now, we as, I see the facing had gone wrong here when we copied it over. We as tax practitioners are engaged there. Typically, people in South Africa need a tax clearance to do any business in South Africa. So when a taxpayer would want to engage in some transaction, they would normally engage with a tax practitioner to get a tax clearance certificate to start that. Then our tax legislation is far from easy to understand. We have made this comment before, and I think many people have done so. We then assist taxpayers in interpreting the complex legislation, understand what their legal rights and obligations are with regard to that. We would typically, in those instances, also issue maybe some tax opinion regarding the application of that. The financial report would then be prepared, and then it would lead to the submission of the finishing of the returns. Now, I'd like to make a comment about that. At the moment, requiring all tax practitioners to be registered, we find that many people are registered merely to assist taxpayers in meeting their filing requirements, or doing no practical tax or high-level tax work. They're really assisting that person to do the e-filing, complete the return, do an application for the tax clearance or whatever is required, or do an application maybe for the tax directive. So this is a fund, and at the moment we see all of those services as part and parcel of the tax services where we are engaged. Of course, if everything works well, and you're lucky, you put your return in within a second, it's assessed, and a couple of days later, the money's in your bank account. But in practice, our members are experiencing that in an increasing number of instances, they have to make objections and appeal. SARS disagrees, and I'll give you an example when I go through some of the other points. Disagrees with the information that you've disclosed and finished to them, issue an assessment, and you then have to engage in process to deal with that. There's dispute, settlements, etc. Now, this is a background. And SARS members are engaged and is inadequately qualified, and it may be remembered that this was what was made earlier, that we have a software-approved qualification. Our members go through rigorous seven-year training, which involves technical and high-level tax training, and then also tactical training, where you engage in a practice where you serve under a person and to get the practical experience there. Of course, SARS may levy penalties, etc., and our members are also engaged in doing that. Now, we now get to the actual regulation of tax practitioners and what we are discussing. The clauses in the taxation or tax administration amendment bill, I'll list on there. We see that the purpose is to regulate tax practitioners. And for this reason, SARS is now proposing that we introduce the recognized controlling body as a body being recognized by the commissioner. So the act proposes to give the powers to SARS, commissioner that we refer to recognize certain bodies as controlling bodies. And you'll see that the act then requires that all tax practitioners must be registered with these controlling bodies. So in essence, a person will no longer, once this becomes law, be able to practice as a tax practitioner, unless that person is registered with such a controlling body. And some of the comments I make will speak specifically to that. Then, similar to the current legislation, the specific instances which would prompt the SARS official to lodge a complaint with the body. You'll recall that the current legislation allows SARS the opportunity if a tax practitioner currently is acting outside of the disciplinary or ethical code of the body, that they can lodge a complaint with that particular body. In the Tax Administration Act Amendment Bill, yeah, they take that much further and list the instances that will require them and under which they can report that tax practitioner to the controlling body. In the clarity memorandum, it specifically explains that this regulation of tax practitioners will be a two-phase approach. The first phase would be the recognizing and the defining of the controlling bodies, and the second phase will be an establishment of an independent regulatory board for tax practitioners, which would then, we'll talk about it now. Now, let's just deal with our comments regarding the controlling bodies. The proposal that we've said is that the listed bodies, there are certain listed bodies, which include IRBA and also the Legal Professional Council and other the Tuesday body that they refer to will be automatically recognized, and then certain of the other bodies that will meet certain requirements, and that's principally four requirements that these bodies must meet. They also must represent a significant number of people, at least 1,000 people, that they may then be recognized by SARS. Now, our concern here, and that led to our submission, is we see from the comments to the draft Immigration Laws Amendment Bill that this is scheduled to become effective 1 April. We have no other indication in the draft legislation of the effective date, but that was communicated to us in that comment on 11 September. We believe that there may be a risk. Bodies such as FICA, and we've already engaged with SARS in this regard, and we'll be meeting with them in 2 weeks' time, believe that we need all the requirements, and if there's certain minor amendments that we must make to our constitution and bylaws to accommodate whatever is required in terms of the Tax Administration Act, we will gladly do so, and we will then, we believe, get approval. And there's certain other current professional bodies that engage tax work that will also do so. But from the numbers we see, and we merely rely on the minister's numbers, 34,000 roughly tax practitioners are registered with SARS, and it looks to our research that they're only about less than 50%. SARS says it's probably more than 50% of these people that are currently registered tax practitioners are belonging to professional bodies. So the concern is that if we promulgate tax and we haven't got a process and in response, you know, a period to allow for a transitional period here, that we might have people that are not registered with these bodies and cannot do the work which they currently are doing and may well be suitably qualified to do so. So they may meet the minimum requirements, but they don't belong to an existing body, and we believe that that is a, that should be addressed, and we should have some transitional rule there to allow for bodies to register and still engage and allow this. I mean, bodies must now position themselves to meet these requirements and register there. Now, the next comment I would like to make deals with the difference between a regulator and a controlling body. And Colin, if you want to make additional comments, you're welcome to do so, so please. I just want to make the initial comment. I explained that this is not currently in the law, but we see that the second phase would involve this regulator being established. Now, currently there is one regulator in South Africa that is relevant to the field, and that's IRBA, the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. And in our comment, we actually make the comment that we don't believe that IRBA has got a tax focus, and we don't actually see the need for a regulator to be established. If we've got a controlling body that meets the requirements, discipline the people, and make certain that they meet minimum standards as required by the legislation, it's not really quite clear why a regulator must be there. Colin, do you want to add there?
No,
that's okay. Then, the Tax Administration Act then specifically deals with minimum qualification and experience requirements and continued professional education requirements, principally saying that a person that engages in the tax field must meet certain theoretical and practical experience, although it doesn't define that, and will then also maintain that body of knowledge. Our comment is that we recommend that that the Act must be specific. We are dealing with tax practitioners. So it merely says you need minimum qualification and experience, and we feel that that should be either tax field. It must be specific. We've got a dedicated course. We take our people when they do their academic qualifications up to the honours level in taxation before we allow them to write our entrance exam. So we have a specific focus on tax as one of the main focus areas. So our comment is that tax practitioners must not only be competent, they must also maintain an up-to-date skill. They must be competent in tax. So this is the comment we make. It is suggested that SARS staff also meet the similar minimum requirement. And if I may just use the personal experience of why I say so, I've been in the last 3-4 weeks had a phone call from a friend of mine to assist with a query that his mother had always submitted the tax return of their company. Once it's been audited, given to them, he submitted, in the year they just did an independent review, submitted the financial statements on the RT14, which is the return of income that you submit. Immediately after the return was submitted, they got a request for supporting documents. It's called an RT14SD. I assisted them with completing that. It was very easy to do the reconciliations. It's a professional practice. It was not very reconciling items. In fact, it turned out that they were out by some 3,000 rand on the turnover. We submitted that detail to SARS. 2 weeks later, she got a call from SARS, where the auditor confirmed that she's working on this audit process. Nearly said, please give me your VAT number and your employee tax registration number, which she promptly gave her the phone. And a couple of seconds later, a couple of minutes later, we had an email and an assessment which stated that we've disallowed all your legal expenses to the tune of 180,000 rand. After a couple of hours of search, we found that the 180,000 related to a sub-consultant which had nothing to do with legal costs. This company has never, over its 15 years history, incurred any legal expenses. So what we are saying is that our experience of our members currently is that it's mainly when we engage on that, as I've said, that process where there's disputes, objections and appeal, that we find that the source staff are not competent in all instances. I'm not saying that they are not competent people, and they are people in the world that I have a high regard for the tech knowledge. But at the poll phase, where we are dealing with that, we find that the people don't understand legislation. They are insisting, I've got a number of examples that we have, and that we are taking up with SARS very shortly in a meeting that Colin and I will be attending, where they merely are not competent and are not qualified to do that. Then we also recommend that the wording expanded to provide some clarity on minimum qualifications to confirm that it's in the tax yield. That brings us to the end of the tax regulation of tax practitioners. Then, Colin, you want to make a...
If I can just come back to the regulation of tax practitioners. When the first draft of legislation came out, we actually had meetings with the then commissioner, now the Minister of Finance, that is, and saying, you know, we understand, we fully approve of regulating tax practitioners. And I think just the number of tax practitioners or persons that have registered with SARS as tax practitioners has grown exponentially over the years. The numbers we've been given is that far more than 50% of the tax practitioners are not members of a recognized professional body. That's the biggest problem. There are many instances that we're aware of that even a firm, an accounting firm, has actually registered their messengers as tax practitioners to get preferential service at a SARS office. You have situations where people are not actually, they're just helping their family and they're registered for as a tax practitioner purely to be able to get the service. They're not even working for an accounting firm. So FICA supports the whole regulation of tax practitioners. But the problem we've got is that SARS brought out legislation or practicalities of registering as a tax practitioner. Unfortunately, at the time, it wasn't properly thought out so that anybody that doesn't actually have the minimum experience or qualifications can register. So there has to be a bit of a backtracking. And we agree with the legislation and suggestions now that people have to have a minimum experience and a minimum expertise. The other problem comes in on a practical basis, and I'm talking simple language. If I take myself, I'm a chartered accountant. I'm also a registered auditor. So I'm registered with IRBA. I'm now bound by the code of conduct of IRBA. If I fail in my duties of professional conduct, I could be subject to a 1 million rand fine. From IRBA, I can be subject to a 1 million rand fine for my institute, FICA. I happen to also be a member of FICA. So if I'm now going to be a member of those three bodies, and registered as a tax practitioner. The first draft of the legislation spoke about the funding of tax practitioner units and the board being funded by SARS for the first year, thereafter funded by subscriptions by its members. And that is why FICA is saying accredit certain professional bodies that meet those minimum requirements, that have got their own rule of professional conduct, because you're going to be taking out, discouraging people from joining in the current situation, to have to be paying four sets of and subscriptions. The other problem you've got at the moment with the practitioners, the tax practitioners, is that there's only a facility to register individuals. There's not a facility to register a firm. Now that is a very serious problem. It hasn't been able to be overcome up to now, and we certainly recommend that SARS re-looks at that whole situation, because if you take one of the big four firms, if you take an individual office of one of the big four, you'll find a maximum of two partners in that firm are actually registered as tax practitioners. You might have 20 or 30 partners, but only one or two are actually registered. So we support SARS's endeavors to change this, but I think it's pretty serious in looking at this. And as Pete said earlier, there is a transitional phase. I'm not worried about those cowboys up there that aren't registered with a professional body. Sorry, I'm actually very much on SARS' side of it. We've seen a lot of Nazis going on. I'm worried about the taxpayers they're assisting, that all of a sudden there's not going to be no assistance. So one needs to have that interim measure. I think we can just carry on.
Just last two comments related to provisional text. We certainly welcome SARS's accepting and basically accepting our proposals to exclude retirement lump sums and severance benefits from the provisional tax regime. It led to unnecessary penalties, and we're really glad that this has been incorporated into the law. Now, what we are now, and I think I must say complaining about, relates to the penalties or additional tax that will be levied where your estimate is wrong. It's up by more than 20%. There's a specific section in the Act, in the Tax Administration Act, that deals with this. But what this amendment bill does is it will make the levying of the penalties absolutely mandatory. So if you're out and it's an automatic computer assessment of that, you are below 20% or you're more than 20% out, it will automatically be levied. We recommend that they retain the current system where this is at the option of SARS, and it would really look at where you haven't seriously dealt with your estimate that a penalty will be levied. So not levying the penalty in all instances, but then only levying that in the instance where there was a serious miscalculation. Want to add?
A number of meetings took place with that particular legislation, and SARS amended legislation to say that SARS may impose a penalty if under due consideration of all facts. And we are asking, because we pointed out the systematic problems. There was an operational issue at SARS on a practical basis, that in any event, as soon as that you were out by more than 20%, you got hit with an automatic penalty. So we strongly suggest the committee relook at that and to change the wording to what SARS agreed to previously, and that is may. I want to go one step further on that, and that the professional bodies have had separate meetings with SARS, with the legal and policy area of SARS, and stated that it should not be an automatic penalty, whether SARS imposes it automatically, compulsory, or voluntarily, if in fact there's an underestimation of taxable income. And the practicalities of that are severe. If you take a financial institution, it takes a financial institution 3 months to get their financial figures up to date. How can an individual do that in their own capacity? And one doesn't have to be a wealthy individual having a few shares or unit trust. It takes a couple of months to get financial information from the various financial institutions. And we've had a number of cases where it's been a complete waste of taxpayers or tax practitioners, as well as SARS, to have to ask, request that those penalties be waived for underpayment. We had a separate meeting with SARS and asked that if sufficient tax has actually been paid, even though there might have been an error, and we're not saying SARS has thrown out those rules, that due process was followed, that you can show SARS that you really did a bit of estimate, you can. But if the actual tax, if the assessment results in a refund, so if enough tax has been paid, then no penalty be imposed. And SARS actually verbally agreed that with the professional bodies. Unfortunately, it seems to have been left out of the draft legislation. So we strongly request the committee request the SARS that put that amendment into the legislation.
Thank you, Colin. Just last few comments. We are finding extreme difficulties in getting people registered for value-added tax. Our members are commenting that it still is a problem. We've met with Treasury after our briefing to Parliament after the budget speech. We were hoping that this would be addressed, as was mentioned in the budget, in the draft legislation. It was not, so we're just raising that comment. There's two issues regarding the 1 October effective date proposed in draft legislation. Section 11D deals with research and development expenses. The Act specifically refers to regulations which must be issued by the Department of Science and Technology. That is not available yet. There is really confusion in the market with regard to the application of that, and it is pity that that is also not being dealt with. Similarly, Section 31, the transfer pricing issue, we have no guidance as yet. We were promised in the draft legislation and in the expansion memorandum to the legislation that the guidance will be made available before the effective date, which is 1 October, and we're just making the point that it is not. We're happy to take your questions later. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee, for the time.
Mr. Chair, can I just read one other point that we didn't put on the slide? And that is the difficulty taxpayers are finding today with tax clearance certificates. This was touched on earlier. That one speaks to stop. The biggest issue nationally is the obtaining of tax clearance certificates. Now, until the Tax Administration Act, there was never a mention of the tax clearance certificate in any tax legislation. It's become a practice in South Africa that all and sundry, be it government, quasi-government, even individual commercial firms, are using that as an example, or probably not to pay clients, saying, please go get a tax certificate. Now, there's very recently been a few more problems on a technical basis, an operational computer basis, IT basis of obtaining tax return certificates. But the Tax Administration Act is now mentioning physically the tax clearance certificate. And it's granting SARS 21 business days to issue a tax clearance certificate. That effectively means 1 month if it's happening in those 21 consecutive days. The legislation doesn't say consecutive days, and I'm not going to be sounding too supercilious, because we are finding extreme cases where the country is losing business. Businesses are taking extreme financial strain to be able to obtain business. And previously they had a policy of 5 working days to obtain a tax clearance, so that you now have 21 days. And we extremely strong as possibly ask this committee to ask ourselves to amend that legislation from 21 days. It's totally unacceptable that people wanting tenders, wanting contracts, are just not able to get them, because 21 days is just totally unacceptable.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think your presentation is very clear. The next presentation is PwC. Power off. Good. I see you advanced now. You are using the iPad. You have to keep up with the new laws coming, eh? All right. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Members, I don't think I'm going to be very long. Some of the topics that I wanted to address have been spoken about now by Cycle way before me. There are 4 points that I wanted to raise. Not only 300 and the fourth one is just a small kind of point more about the process and form that I'll mention right to the end if I don't run out of time. And certainly items 1 and 2 have already been raised by FICA, so maybe we'll deal with them relatively quickly. On the question of registration of taxpayers, again, as an overall point, this is something that PwC welcomes, and we are supportive of SARS's initiative for taxpayers to register and for there to be some level of regulation. Just a couple of points of detail that we think need to be addressed. The section 4240 of the Tax Administration Act requires that tax practitioners must register with a recognized controlling body, and also it also prescribes when a person may not register. So just the 2 points of detail that we think is absent from this. There's no ability in the legislation for SARS to cancel someone's registration. So if they are registered as a tax practitioner and they misbehave, there's no mechanism for them to be deregistered. And similarly, even if what we think will need to go along with that is if someone is deregistered, what prevents them from re-registering immediately? So just 2 points of view we think need to be addressed in the legislation. The ability to deregister a taxpayer and the prevention or restriction of immediate re-registration of disqualified practitioners. Then one of the points that were made earlier as well is that there needs to be a controlling body, a recognized controlling body that practitioners need to be registered. This is in phase one of SARS's regulation proposal. And just again, another point of detail, the South African Legal Practice Council, the Legal Practice Bill Act, which will eventually hasn't been enacted, so we don't think it's appropriate that it can be referred to or relied upon in the legislation that's proposed at present. Then, a point about timing and a little bit of background, and this was raised as well before, there's a process where SARS is required to recognize professional bodies, and I want to point out here that in terms of the Tax Administration Act, if you do operate as a tax practitioner, if you're not registered, that's a criminal offense. Now, the problem with this is between now and the effective date, and I know it's been proposed on the 1st of April, we don't think there's going to be enough time for the formal recognition process to happen and for all of these tax practitioners to register with the various controlling bodies. So our submission there is that the effective date, so the due date, needs to be postponed. We don't think 1 April gives sufficient time for that registration process to happen. Then, the next point I wanted to talk about was just quickly on the provisional tax penalties, and this is almost a repeat of what Pitt Mel from Piker was talking about. And again, just a little bit of background, the current law is that if you, for certain taxpayers, if you make the mistake of underestimating your provisional tax, the current law is that SARS is required to apply their mind before issuing a penalty. So the penalty provision is there. Colin Wilson may emphasize the word may, and the importance of the word may is that it doesn't take the penalty away, it just puts an obligation upon SARS to think about it. Is it reasonable? Was this a reasonable mistake? Because at the end of the day, this is just intended, always intended to be an estimation. The actual final tax calculation comes much later. And this proposal before us now says SARS doesn't have to do anything if you miss it. Penalty is automatic. So I think right there is probably our first submission, but we haven't made a submission on that point Mike has. What our submission says is that even if you do go ahead with that process, there's no mechanism for the penalty to be waived. So if the penalty gets imposed automatically, if this proposal goes through, and an attack layer comes with all his or her paperwork and says, but this is what I did, and there was a reasonable estimation, and there was no intention here to deliberately underestimate. There's no mechanism, SARS haven't given him permission to actually waive the penalty, which is a remission that is available to other provisional taxpayers, and under a Lin Rand is the remission available. The remission hasn't been written in the case. So in essence, there are really two things there. Then what I wanted to spend the bulk of my time is on the point about legal professional privilege, and with the current sort of discussion about the regulation of tax practitioners and all of that being back in focus, our primary mission is that this is precisely the point at which we need to raise this issue and debate the point about legal professional privilege for tax practitioners other than lawyers. And the commentary that I want to make is under those headings, those are the statements essentially that I want to make is that point number one, now is the time. Will and we've heard comments that we need to defer this, and my point is now is particularly the time. I want to make a few points on what is the rationale for privilege, professional privilege, and why tax practitioners should qualify for privilege. And then a few additional points that I'm going to add right in there just because now I'm going to run out of time, so we'll add him like that. Point number one is now the time. The issue of privilege was raised several times before and in a very, sometimes very animated session when we were going through the process of a tax administration bill, which now is Tax Administration Act. And the point at that stage was, look, we're not going to consider privilege for tax practitioners until we start the process of regulating tax practitioners. Tax practitioners need to be regulated, and then we can talk about privilege. And so our response to that is, look, regulation on tax practitioners is on the table now. This has not been precisely the time. The follow-up response to that is, actually, the regulation proposal comes in two phases. Phase one and phase two. Phase one is where we're in now. Maybe we should wait until phase two. But our opposition draft is like this. Phase one is effectively an attempt at self-regulation, where you have all of these controlling bodies, and SARS wants to see to what extent is this going to be effective. The Pikers of the world, to what extent the Urbans of the world, what extent are they going to be effective in regulating tax practitioners? And SARS themselves have made the point that if that works, there will be no way to. There will be no way to because there won't be a need for SARS to actually reach in and take control of this themselves and have an independent regulatory body if self-regulation effectively works. So our point there is we have to have a discussion now because phase two may never happen. Then, there's a whole host of reasons that we put under the heading of the rationale for privilege, but I really want to, and I'm not going to deal with all of these points, the relatively self-evident, but I really want to talk about the point about public interest. And perhaps, if we look at legal privilege in the context of lawyers, people with many, many reasons why privilege exists and why it should be protected, but really right at the absolute top of that list, and that's the one that I want to talk about, and that is the fact that in an attempt to assist citizens to comply, the attorney needs 100% of all of the information. So the purpose, the real primary reason for privilege is to ensure that citizens who may not be complying with the law are able to be brought into to effectively to be brought into complying with the law. And in this respect, And I want to bring it back to the point about tax petitioners and go to the next point as well. I want to read an extract from a report from 2008. I've tabled this in this forum before. The OECD has, as one of its fora, has this forum on tax administration. The one that was held in 2008, incidentally, was held in Cape Town. And the chairperson of the forum, the Cape Town Forum in 2008, was the then SARS Commissioner, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, and he, in fact, wrote forward to this report. And I want to read just one small bit from, this is from page 14, where it talks about the role of tax advisors in compliance, and they extract lines like this. The importance of the role tax advisors play in a tax system can be tested by answering a simple question. Would compliance with tax laws improve if tax advisors did not exist? The study team, this is the OECD study team, found no single country where the answer to that question was yes. In fact, across a whole range of taxpayers and circumstances, the vast majority of tax advisors help the client to avoid errors and deter them from engaging in unlawful or overly aggressive activities. Now, that is the role of the tax practitioner by and large. If we ask the question, why should tax practitioners be given legal privileges? Precisely that point. The taxpayer wants to know, the tax practitioner needs to get 100% of all of the information from taxpayer in order to best help them, and best help them to do what? To best help them to come and operate inside the law. So precisely the same rationale as for the common law legal privilege, and I want to make the point that in South Africa, which is no different from the majority of the rest of the world, that most tax advice and tax compliance is provided by non-lawyers. There's a whole bunch of other reasons as well why we can talk about why this privilege should extend to tax practitioners, and the ones that I wanted to emphasize I already have. Then just to end off on this particular point, I can talk quite a lot about the 3 points on this last slide as well, but I was concerned I will run out of time. I want to make the statement that, number one, there are strict requirements before privilege can apply, and, like, for example, it must be given in a professional capacity. And there are a couple of requirements as well. There are arguments against the extension of privilege, but the statement that I wish to make is that the arguments for granting of privilege outweigh those with the arguments against. There is sufficient legal precedent of other jurisdictions that do have limited privilege granted to tax practitioners, again, precisely for the purpose of assisting taxpayers in complying with the law. And I suppose my closing point here is, in where South Africa is at the moment and the current relationship between SARS and tax practitioners, I suppose my overarching statement is this is precisely what is needed now, is to increase and maintain the level of compliance by taxpayers and have them sign the tax net. So that's really the third point that I wanted to make. The fourth one, as I said, was just a small point regarding to form and process, I suppose. This is the clause one of the tax of the Amendments Act, Amendment Bill. And clause one deals with enacting international agreements on combined border control posts, and there's no issue with that. I just wonder question whether it's appropriate to include this in an Amendments Act, because if this is something that's bringing something into law for the first time, if in future years we need to find where exactly was the enactment, it seems to be stuck away in one of the annual amendment bills or one annual amendment act, it really should be in the main text of the Customs and Excise Act. Is our submission. Thank you very much.
Let's talk, honorable members. According to my program, we have an opportunity to interact with the two submissions, either in the form of questions or comments. Over to you. Oh. Welcome, honorable Ambrosini. I'm not saying you should speak, I'm just recognizing, I'm just welcoming you. Madlamin will be followed by Ambrosini, followed by Tim Harris, Honorable Harris. Honorable Ross, Honorable Kodanoff.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I would like to take the opportunity to thank the two presenters for spending your time and give us some informative information on the tax administration amendment bill. thank you for your time. There are two issues in there for both presenters. There is a concern about time. Now, when you are doing your research or when you're going through the amendments on the recognition of a controlling body, the main issue is it you I see are you foresee a problem where the taxpayers will not get enough to, like the taxpayers will not get the service. Taking for an example, if maybe the people or the practitioners that they are using, they are still undergoing the process of the recognition, is that an issue? If then that is an issue, because for me, if that is the issue, then even July is closed, which has been proposed by the PwC, because I am thinking that looking at the database that you have assessed the job that needs to be done, you have assessed all the processes and the systems that are to be put in place for recognizing that kind of practitioners is a problem. So can we just get exactly because it simply is a problem, and if we push on this tight time frame, then it might give us a problem. The other issue is the maybe. I think it's on the provisional tax, the maybe. What is important for me is what was presented by the PwC, when the PwC says, here is a person, and the practitioner has submitted all the documentation. For some other reason, the documentation were omitted, not deliberately, they were omitted by mistake. There was a serious mistake on submission of documentation. And the person submits those documentation to SAT, but because of the law that has been put in place, the SAT says, well, it's penalty. It's such a thing. It's exactly what you're saying. Thank you.
Honourable Mario Rossini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At times, I was the benefit of studying a bill before the public hearings. This time around, I must admit that I came to listen to the public submissions to help me understanding the bill. So I will react to what I've heard with apologies for not having studied the bill yet. I will do that this afternoon with the benefit of what has been said here now. But just reacting to what I heard, I have a couple of concerns, questions that can be addressed. The first one, I'm a lawyer, come from a legal background, so I will tend to look at tax practitioners as somebody who does effectively the work of a lawyer in a field which is specialized. They are not different from patent lawyers. Are people representing clients' interest in dealing with a specific branch of government in applying a set of law. So not that different from criminal lawyers, so much so because tax laws have got very very severe sanctions violated, ranging from penalties to jail sentences. So if that comparison is one that stands, I don't understand why SAS would have the power to launch a complaint against the activity of a tax practitioner. It is only the client which should be able to do so, and what they should, and I said that there is an independent regulatory body, but if there is criminal conduct, then there should be actions against the tax practitioner in that sense. But it's a question. The second question, Mr. Chairman, you may remember that when we did the tax amendment bill 2 years ago, and that was the first race there, my apologies. I expressed very serious concerns about the entire notion of automatic penalties in case you get it wrong in reading your future, your tax future. Now, we are moving one step forward, and the argument given to us at the time was, well, most people know how much money they're going to make, and that they can very well pay it now. True, most people do. But when you say most, means that some don't.
there are entire classes of people out there who work on commissions, who work on success fees, and they end up with zero or nothing. So I do also have a great concern on how those who are not part of most that fall in the category of SAM can be accommodated by these amendments. The third aspect, it's a correction, if I may be allowed to do for in semantics to what presenters of SAICA, where they said, well, please ask SARS to make amendments to this bill. I mean, this is our bill. And I accept that the committee projects the image of not being a very redrafting committee or other committees redraft everything, but this is our bill, and if members of the committee are willing, ready, and able to change, we will change it. So any drafting that you want to help this committee with, any proposed amendment, at least as far as I'm concerned, I'm sure many of my colleagues, may be concerned, are welcome if you can propose text that with an independent mind, and you should abide by our constitutional mandate of applying our mind independently. Thank you.
I see that PwC, obviously thank you for both your presentations, but PwC has specified a proposed date to extend the requirement for registration to the 1st of July. I'm interested in SAICA's view, is that sufficient time? It does seem quite alarming that we've only got 50% registration. We're dealing with a shortfall of about 17,000 tax petitioners. We are probably going to need more time, but is that 1 July sufficient? Then a question for both presenters. The requirements, or rather for SAICA first, the requirements that continuing professional education requirements includes a tax component. In a memo to the bill, it implies that will be in the regulations. I think that's the correct, but I don't think there's any need to amend the bullet points of requirements. We can put that in the regulations, and I happen to agree that it should be there and that there should be reciprocity with SARS. But are you satisfied if it appears in the reg? Then the requirement for registration as a controlling body. I'm trying to understand the environment properly. Who currently would be eligible under those requirements? The four bullet points, minimum qualification and continuing professional education, etc. That's the requirement that you at least have 1,000 members. Obviously, IRBA is there. PwC says that the SALPC doesn't exist yet and requires a further law to be passed. Which other bodies could possibly fulfill those requirements? Then on the two issues of VAT registration and tax clearance certificates, I understand what's happened with VAT registration, that when you make it too simple, you end up with cheating. But when you make it too rigid, then you I guess the risk is that you push people into the informal sector. Do you have an estimate to what extent we're doing that? We're pushing people outside the law because we're making compliance too difficult. And what would you propose as an alternative to the system? I mean, could work, for example, that you donors on SARS to follow up after their certificate is assigned, rather than before, rather than requiring this onerous process before you assign the certificate. And then on the tax clearance certificate, let's have it there. The issue about a controlling body versus a regulator, in the memo it suggests that once we've, in the first phase we establish these controlling bodies, in the second phase we establish an independent regulatory board. I guess this becomes a question for SARS. Chair, I'm hoping we can ask them questions as well now. SAICA is saying that if you have a controlling board, why do you need a regulator? It is an interesting question. Maybe SARS can give us the justification for that new structure. And then another question for SARS. It's a valid point, I think, is this idea that the provisional tax penalty simply kicks in at the maximum. It does seem to me to be a preferable model to allow that flexibility as we did before. And then the PwC, on slide 4, you speak about this, the fact that there's no prohibition of re-registration on slide 3. The memo to the bill suggests that the requirement to modify to provide the taxpayer may not be registered if he or she has been removed from a professional body or convicted for a crime involving dishonesty in the preceding 5 years. I mean, to me, that appears to satisfy your concern that perhaps I'm missing something. And then you would like PwC to see SARS having the ability to cancel registrations. I'm slightly uncomfortable with that. I mean, SARS has the ability to approve, or the minister has the ability to approve a controlling body, and that's sufficient. I mean, that he essentially has oversight over the whole structure, but without getting into the details of individual membership. I think that's the appropriate balance. I would be quite uncomfortable with SARS having the ability to cancel registration of individual members with controlling bodies. You have to be satisfied that the controlling body will do these things in their own interests. And then lastly, just some detail on the international precedent for professional privilege. How many countries have some element of privilege and how many don't? And perhaps some examples of countries that are at a similar size to ours, a similar stage of development. What has been their experience? We essentially, I think my instinct is to agree with you, but I almost need more convincing as to why, relative to other markets, this is something that can and should work here. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My first one is just a concern addressed to Professor Nell. We all support the to exclude the retirement fund lump sum benefits, the amendment that we accepted. But just in terms of protecting of retirement funds, are there not any unintended consequences in terms of regulation that we now discard to safeguard, you know, protection funds to the maximum? Just the unintended consequences of this amendment. We do support it, of course. We know it should be excluded, and it's to the benefit of savers. But just, is there any unintended consequences regarding this? And then my second one to Professor Orman. Very interesting to me is the privilege for and the argument against. And I would just like, I'd be very interested to hear, is it actually the privilege, is it the regulated tax practitioners versus the legal profession to a certain extent in terms of the privilege that we are looking for as follow-up in terms of the regulation later on? And what do we do? Well, certainly we would like to have the interest of the taxpayers to source the maximum knowledgeable advice. And I think that should be our departure point. And what would be the interest of, what would be the interest for those taxpayers? And then just a practical example, we have people qualified and doing a study in DREC LLB, which is a dual course. And how do you then find a balance in terms of those highly professional people that can add so much value if we have a privilege for a specific sector?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Also, let's say, I think it's a very fair comment by both the presentations on various issues, and definitely will have my support. But on the privilege, I'm also a lawyer. You know, tongue in cheek, I would say, if you allow the auditors, they will become surgeons too. So my only question is, why don't you employ more lawyers? It's as simple as that. And secondly, I think you understand privilege slightly wrong. If I give you advice as a lawyer how to do a certain thing, that's not privilege. You cannot go to a court and say, you know, I claim privilege now. I've been to a lawyer how to murder my wife, and I've done it now according to his advice. So, sorry, there is not privilege like that. And if you are serious about that, if not in the poll, can we see some proposals? Will you put your pen on paper and give us some proposals? And then I will also suggest that if Price Waterhouse is serious about that, get us a good legal opinion, if you can find one, to give legal privilege to the auditors.
Mabu Van Rooyen, you made the speech.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, of course, the presentations were welcome. Two specific questions. Saita argued that tax practitioners must be considered as they work maybe in a firm or maybe as a company. I just wanted to confirm and think of that submission. Does it imply that individual practitioners must not be considered? And obviously, is that the case, that might necessarily imply that we don't encourage standalone practitioners. So also encourage, in a way, I mean, like a gatekeeping exercise. So I just want to clear my understanding around that particular submission. And also on this issue of the one that was posed outside the presentation, the need to revisit the 21 days provision for issuing tax clearance. My little understanding around the issuance of a tax clearance certificate is that this is more of a compliance issue that is done annually. So I'm not sure when does this 21 days take in. I mean, because if really there is compliance, there's no need even to get to that. So I'm not sure why I bring this as an issue. If that's the case, could you please clarify my concept? Thank you.
It's your time to respond. Yeah, you can sit there. Can you so that you can see? At least from the front, at least from the back.
So, Chair, the number of questions that I'll maybe take the answers to the members that mind me taking them up, so I can deal with all the questions that I will deal with at one time. The question was asked twice by two different members about the timing. We are concerned about the timing, that if this regulation of tax practitioners comes in April, and one request was to perhaps consider to extend that to July, would that be sufficient time? To be honest, we are concerned even if it was July. We've had certain discussions with SARS. We meet with SARS on a quarterly basis in terms of discussing operational issues. And one of the issues that has come about is the whole regulation of tax practitioners. And what wasn't mentioned in the presentations is the concern by the minister in his budget speech of the number of tax practitioners themselves who are not properly or totally tax compliant in terms of returns owing, outstanding or money owing. And that's something that maybe I just want to bring to the table. These are members of professional bodies and members are not members of professional bodies. So the whole timing of the issue of taking up the controlling bodies, are recognizing these. It's not a concern from SARS' point of view, and I'm speaking as a member of FICA, those members are members of FICA. The concern is actually the members who are not members of any professional body. And FICA is quite willing to work with SARS and National Treasury on assisting them on that very particular point. We've had initial discussions on that, and FICA itself has been considering opening up itself to having maybe a second tier of membership who are not charged accountants, to try and assist us and to make sure that these people would be regulated. So my answer to that is, we are concerned of the timing, but FICA is willing to assist SARS and National Treasury in to maybe find a home for those particular people who are not members of professional bodies. The second question...
If I can interrupt to go along... On the PwC suggestion, one of the things I perhaps should clarify is that our suggestion of 1 July was really focused on bodies like FICA and members and individuals who are already members of FICA.
We think in that respect, April is too short, but July is slightly more doable because they are already on the radar screen. That's what Colin just said now about tax practitioners who are not a member of anybody. I don't think anyone has the answer on what we're looking at there.
Just to touch on a point that the Honourable Member Ambrosini raised, and that was that whether it should be SARS reporting to a professional body or to the taxpayer himself. There's been legislation in South Africa for donkey's years, Section 105, I think it was, an old act, where staff were able to report the unprofessional conduct of a particular member to the professional bodies. In 25 years, I'm aware of two cases that have been reported. We've already decided it was not reported enough. We do not tolerate our members misbehaving or being cowboys as SACA members. But the point is well taken. Remember that, you know, whether SARS or the taxpayer should report. Very often the taxpayer is not even aware of the criminal activity of the tax practitioner. The next...
Can I also add, I understood that question slightly differently, so let me just say my two cents. The issue is, who is ultimately responsible? Is it a taxpayer or is it the tax practitioner? Why should the tax practitioner get into trouble if we talk about the tax affairs of the taxpayer? And I think that system has been in place forever because ultimately it's always the taxpayer who is ultimately responsible and has to sign the tax return, and SARS always effectively goes back to the taxpayer, and I think that's appropriate. But I think increasingly now when we, on the tax practitioner side, want to claim that, you know, tax is a very complex area and taxpayers need our assistance and all of that, then I mean, I think with that kind of claim all comes the responsibility. So I don't think there can be any denial about tax practitioners who go and sell aggressive tax schemes to taxpayers. Now, how is SARS supposed to get that then? Because actually, even though the taxpayer is ultimately responsible, you need to kind of have some kind of sanction against those abusive tax practitioners as well. So we're fully supportive of SARS having some kind of mechanism to bring to book tax practitioners. So that's why we've always been, I mean, it's, as Colin was saying, it's been in the law for a long time, and we've always been supportive of, you know, almost naming and shaming.
The next point I just want to apologize to the committee, and that is where I request that we are sought to be dropped. Legislation. I can tell you, in office of SACA, we're quite willing to assist the committee to redraft any tax legislation as required. As an opening and generalized comment, we're quite happy to do that. The question came up about that registration and follow-ups by SAR thereafter. Is there a mechanism to follow up? For the last 4 years, the biggest issue that our professional body had and was raised at the quarterly stakeholders meetings with SARS was that registration. This is the biggest challenge to both tax practitioners as well as SARS and bills. And SAIC has always said, a lot of that registration, and I'm saying that notwithstanding the fact that SAIC is fully aware of the amount of that fraud and fraudulent registrations that have tried to take place, and unfortunately have managed to stop some of those. And we've encouraged SARS to actually publicize it. The problem is that for a few bad eggs, it's hitting the whole economy. People, I had a phone call today from an international client saying, how long will it take me to get a VAT registration? They're going to be supplying things to the South African government. And when I answered them, maybe we'll be lucky to get it within 3 months. They just said, well, that's impossible because we're about we've signed the heads of agreement, we need to do business in the next month. And I said, well, we'll try everything we can do. But the answer to the question was, is there any follow-up? And FIAC has already said, SARS must take one of their current procedures about checking into the genuine business. The problem is actually when you're about to start a business, how do you prove the turnover? And I'll just give you an example. When Massmart came to South Africa, Massmart was turned down to get that registration. Now, Massmart has to be a fairly large company. I happen to be sitting in the South Head office at the day when that happened. Not Massmart, Walmart, when Walmart bought over Dion and Game. And Macro, how could they get a VAT registration? You could not prove that such a thing is going to be there. And that's when SARS very positively looked at the situation. But we understand the balance that SARS has got to do between fraudulent registrations and genuine cases. But we've got a lot of genuine cases, companies wanting to start in South Africa, be it overseas companies and even local businesses. How do you prove that your turnover is going to be more than R1 million for an obligatory registration? And how do you prove 3 months of bank statements when your turnover is going to be more than 50,000 rand per annum being the day minimum? causes practical situations in that you have to bring the 3 months of tax statement, so you can't even apply for 3 months. And that is a difficulty. But I'll go back to the question and say, SOS does have the ability to follow up and audit that refund. And I think what's very relevant now is that since March this year, when SARS introduced the modernization of the VAT system, where you supply your file VAT return, and according to SARS' risk engine, they automatically send you an email back, please provide supporting documentation. And the letter goes out, and there's certain context where they will say, well, is there a capital item speaker that send us the invoices for the capital items? So SARS has come a long way in the last few months, or let's say the last year, in ways of following up that refund. And that's why we think, don't make it so difficult for businesses to have that refund. And I'm not saying stop all the initial tests or visiting the premises, having the supporting documentation, etc. But don't prevent businesses doing that registration. The same way that we sort of touched on now, that when you find that there's a modernization of the company tax return, that if it hits the risk engine or doesn't qualify, or whatever the right words are, you automatically within minutes get a request for supporting documentation for a company return, IT-14, where you have to do reconciliation. So it's come a long way in a very short period of time, able to pick up per their risk engine that they will need to look at certain supporting documents, and that doesn't only apply in case of tax refunds. The next question I wanted to raise was under the provisional tax line, the penalty. It has been pointed out to me that I didn't properly read the wording, and I'm not sure it was the first draft of the automatic penalty. But what you said in the presentation about SARS may or must do the penalty must stand. My comment was, in terms of where you pay sufficient tax, either PAYE or provisional tax, that there would not be an automatic penalty if it's a case of a refund. I would like to raise a point, and that will be limit the magical figure of 1 million rand was introduced 2 years ago. There's now been no change to that figure. And we have to know a number of people, a number of companies, went to our mining companies, etc., where the increases in salaries, etc., have gone up quite substantially. And as a sort of side point, would suggest that this committee considers raising that 1 million rand level, because it applies not only to individuals, but applies to companies as well. And that could be raised on an annual basis, even taking CBI into account.
Can I just use this opportunity to clarify some of the things Colin just said regarding the poll tax penalty? And I think I want members to be clear that we're talking about three separate issues here, three separate points here. Point number one that we agree upon, and this is a question that was raised, was, is the proposal for an automatic penalty, and that is the third submission, that is the one we oppose. That is opposed in the context of a penalty. If people deliberately underestimate the provisional tax for the sake of, you know, saving their cash flow, then they should be penalized. So the concept of a penalty stays. The question is, should it be automatic and compulsory without someone at SARS first applying their mind and saying, well, show me what you did. And if you show them what they did and it's reasonable, then a penalty shouldn't be imposed. And if you aren't able to convince them, then the penalty applies. So that's our first submission. It shouldn't just be automatic. The second point that Carl just made was that sometimes, at least technically possible, and it does really happen in practice, it is possible to underestimate your taxable income, which is one number, but still actually end up paying the right amount of tax for too much. In that case, the submission is that there shouldn't be any penalty at all, even though the first number is underestimated. You ended up paying the right tax. And then the third point was, if the proposal for this is something that I'm angry that Scott didn't say, was if the proposal for a compulsory penalty goes ahead, how can there not be some process for a request for remission or some kind of process to get the penalty waived? So those are the three points I want people to be clear on.
If I just can add, I want to give an example of where provisional payment has gone wrong and then explain just the logic for why we are asking for some just protection here for us as practitioners. It's a time-consuming effort. If you're getting to the end of your tax year, you're putting in your last estimate, your final estimate, you're still busy with an estimate. You cannot reliably predict what your final numbers will be. The example I have, we've made a reference to gold, or to mining, the gold mining company. They put the estimates based on the numbers that they had to the end of January. They extrapolated that to the end of February, and it turned out that they were breaking down a machine towards the end of February. And when this machine was finally broken down, it turned out there was some gold caught in this machine.
And when we valued the roles and brought that in the closing stock, the cost part of that gold, that meant that they were out more than the 20%. Now, that certainly is something that was not deliberate, and when we objected, that penalty disappeared. But it's just showing that you cannot be 100% accurate. At the moment, the system is going, making it compulsory. It's putting immense pressure on practitioners and taxpayers alike to come up with a reasonable, and we actually try and overestimate, and that brings its own problems. And if you overestimate, then you're due for a refund, which leads to an ordered additional cost spend in sorting the problem out resolved. So that's why we're asking, raising this point with regard to the provisional tax penalties.
I think just to clarify just one sentence further on that, the majority of accounting firms, audit firms, handling provisional tax loss claims actually start their work towards the end of December, beginning of January. The returns have to be filed by the end of February. You need to give time to add a few notice on that. So when you do the calculations in January, the best figures you've got are till December, and you're having to extrapolate the figures of best of the knowledge between January and for the 2 months of January and February. And that's the practical difficulty of doing that estimate. If I can move to the next question, and that was the registration of tax practitioners, the confusion of one of our members. Currently, the system is that only an individual can be registered as a tax practitioner. My comment is that there is no facility to register a firm as a tax practitioner. I'm not advocating that itself applies as individuals can't be registered. I'm saying that part of the system needs to also change to be able to register a professional firm as a tax practitioner and maybe have a sub-registration of each of the individual partners. Because practically what happens, my staff in my office phone up and ask, I want to do all the phone calls. And they are having to go to my name, my ID number and all the details, but they're actually acting on my behalf. That applies in every accounting firm in the country. The last question that was raised was the explanation gentlemen in front of me about the 21 days for the tax clearance certificates. The issue is that practically when one applied for the tax clearance certificate in the past, SARS would provide it within five working days. The Tax Administration Act now allows SARS to take 21 business days to provide you with a tax clearance certificate. Now, a tax clearance certificate actually is an annual event, because when you have a tax clearance certificate, it is valuable a period of 1 year. You can't actually practically today, if I know that my tax clearance certificate expires expires at the end of November, I can't apply now for the next one. The system doesn't actually allow that. I've got to wait for it to expire or to 5 days before to apply, and I then have to wait 21 days. The SARS officials are saying I've got to wait 21 business days before they'll issue it again. That means I'm not going to be able to tenders or contracts or do business for 21 days because I'm prevented from getting these contracts until I provide a tax clearance certificate. I trust that answers or clarifies the question.
Okay, I'll continue just hopefully very quickly with some of the questions that were addressed to me and to the extent that haven't already been answered by Colin. Just a point about tax practitioner registration and our point about SARS having the authority to deregister. And I take the point about should SARS have that kind of authority. And it was really just a small point about the concept of deregistration. Once someone is inside the system, there's nothing in the legislation. So it doesn't have to be with SARS, it can be out there. But just the concept, provision needs to be made the provision is made for you to enter the system, there's no provision for you to be kicked out, is I think the point that we're making. Then on the points, there were a few points about privilege, and one of the questions, if perhaps I can respond to in writing, and that was a question about other countries, because I'll list some of them here, but there was a suggestion that we make some firm proposals, so maybe I'll include more detail in the written proposal. But I'll point out that in all of these jurisdictions I'm about to mention, we are talking about limited privilege, and I think that is appropriate. And that includes the US, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and Germany. And the extent to which they plan how they work, how it works is the kind of thing, the detail that are offered in the written proposal. But I do want to also set the point about the whole thing about lawyers and non-lawyers. And I think as a firm like PwC, even though we employ, as far as our audit and assurance practice is concerned, mostly accountants, I do want to make the point that in our tax practice, we're about 50% lawyers. And the issue there, and it's really funny to be in the office because the lawyers always think they know better, actually, the accountants, I think they know better. But the issue is that there is fraught with legal debates about when is, and sorry if I can interrupt myself, just go clarify the principle about understanding privilege. There was no suggestion that we're talking about our advice, just claim privilege over our advice. What we are talking about here is the ability for client to come and we can give him the assurance that you can tell me everything. So what you tell me is privilege. And I think that's the correct understanding of where privilege belongs. And that's what, really what we're on about. In order for us to be able to help you most effectively, you need to give us the whole story because we don't want surprises down the line because you lied to someone else. You know? So having said that, even if we employ more lawyers, there are legal opinions written about, for example, if a company employs a lawyer, not a law firm, a normal corporate tax, they employ a lawyer and employs him or her to do their tax work, if they're in-house tax counsel, is the information that they get from their colleagues, that privilege, is legal opinion that is not. When lawyers are employed by accountants within accounting firms, are you acting in your capacity as a consulting lawyer or your employee of an accountant? So there's a lot of debate and confusing, you know, legalese about that. So what we're saying now is, and if I can go to the point also that you made about, you know, graduates who's got to be like, you know, really clever and able to do the stuff, and maybe I'll include in that also, there's another sector which is SARS employees or ex-SARS employees who know a lot about tax and they do tax work as well. What we say is that now for the first time you have one single box where you can put all of them into, which is we get to call a tax practitioner, a regulated or registered tax practitioner, where there's nothing to do all the issues about what capacity are you acting in, are you a lawyer, are you acting in the capacity of a lawyer, we're going to say you are acting in the capacity as a regulated tax practitioner, and then if you fall in that box, then the privilege, that's where we're looking to point privilege. And if you inside that box, then it applies, and if you're not, so I think that's really the what we think becomes simple about all of these debates and just to repeat the point I made earlier on, the request for a proposal and perhaps maybe some legal opinion, I'll certainly follow up on that and present it to the committee.
Thank you very much. After listening to these two presentations and your responses, I'm just asking myself if your colleague will still want to continue to make presentations after these two presentations, but I'm certain they will. And then I see Thomas want to say something. Can you come back after our 5 minutes left stretch? Okay.
There was one or two more questions that we haven't dealt with. Are we going to do with that after the 5 minutes?
No. You are done.
Are we done?
2 minutes. Your response. No.
Okay, I've got 2 minutes. Thank you. I will deal with the Honourable Harris's point regarding the continued professional education requirements that will come in the regulations. And we didn't have any insight to that. We couldn't comment on that. And it would have been, of course, very nice to have that available to comment and see what is required. As we think we sort of have an idea what is required to keep people up to date in the tax field. And then with regard to the Honourable Ross's question regarding the retirement lump sum, the principle that we objected to and that was recognised in the amendment law was that when we calculate the provisional tax penalty or whether it's the current law, it looks at taxable income. And taxable income currently includes your lump sum, your severance and retirement benefits, which are subject to a separate tax table. So they shouldn't really influence, and if you do the numbers, will not influence your tax. Your tax or provisional tax payment. And that is what was corrected in the legislation. There's no unintended consequences. There still is not an incentive for a person to take early withdrawal from lump sum because that eats away in your tax-free, into your tax-free 315,000 exempt amount. So I think the legislation currently itself, we just found that people paying on retirement automatically were getting penalties because they underestimated the provisional tax, and the reason for that was the lump sum, which had nothing to do with the provisional tax, and that's why our commission addressed that. And the last comment, Chair, if I may, SACA's, it's currently running into 10 pages, is busy with the submission on VAT registration after so we will do that, and we'll comment on that going forward. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, let's have our 5 minutes left, right? I just want to assure you that the Honourable Russell didn't ask about the lump sum issue because it's about to retire very young. Thank you.